It's the Korean Fail edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Korea Fail Science, Reproductive Music, Reading God's Mind, and part one of two of an interview with economist
Iglika Ivanova.
This week, tuition fees and funding universities.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, but we are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is my name unknown, Don, speaking as a skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Sorry, Ethan. You're known as Ethan?
I am known as Ethan.
So do you have a sign saying, I am Ethan?
I do. Yeah. I have a son that says, I am Ethan. Yes.
But, you know, it's interesting labels and stuff
like
that.
Well, I mean, like I'm not objectively called Ethan. Like, it's not like if you assembled all the atoms of my body, it would form an Ethan. I am only known because that has been the name given to me.
That's a label they placed upon you.
Exactly.
So, labels, are they important in the world?
Yes, they're very important.
So, the fact that we may or may not mention certain aspects about you kind of diminishes your whole existence in some ways.
Possibly, but more on that later.
Well, speaking of a torturous introduction to an interesting study in Korea.
What a great segue. Well, actually, we do have a bit of bad news here on Radio Free Thinker because this is one of the all-time science/anti-science fails, depending on how you'd like to phrase that terminology. And this one has been committed on a national scale. This one committed by South Korea banning evolution from its textbooks and across the country, giving in to pressure from creationists. The story was reported by Nature, and it relates to the shocking national dumbening, which is my word, of what South Korea has done here. It began when a petition to remove references to evolution from high school textbooks succeeded last month after the Ministry of Education, Science and Technology, the MEST, revealed that many of the publishers would produce revised editions that exclude examples of evolution of horses and of avian ancestors, the Archaeopteryx. Not surprisingly, the country's leading biologists were not consulted. To quote, the ministry just sent out the petition out to the publishing companies and let them judge, says Dayak Jang, a evolutionary scientist at Seoul National University, Seoul National University. The campaign was led by the Society for Textbook Revise, STR, which aims to delete the, quote, error of evolution from textbooks and to, quote, correct students' view of the world, according to the Society's webpage. The STR is an independent offshoot of the Korea Association for Creation Research, the KACR, complicated acronyms. According to spokespeople, the impact of the KACR efforts, creation science, have allowed for the dumbening of South Korea in respects to biology. So one might say, well, how could this possibly have happened? One possible theory is that South Korea is a particularly God-fearing country. A 2009 survey conducted for the South Korean documentary The Era of God and Darwin, almost one-third of the respondents didn't believe in evolution. Of those, 41% said that there was insufficient scientific evidence to support it, 39% said that it contradicted their religious beliefs, and 17% did not understand the theory. The numbers approached those in the United States, where a survey of by the researcher firm Gallup showed that around 40% of Americans do not believe that humans evolved from less advanced forms of life. So about half the people of South Korea practice religion. The two main religions are Christianity and Buddhism.
Actually, and I think it's an important note here, is that evangelicals, American evangelicals, have a very, very strong presence in South Korea. In fact, one of the reasons why you tend to get a lot of South Korean students and that in the United States and Canada is part of this sort of missionary work. So I think, you know, layered onto this is just not only Christianity, but a particular brand of Christianity that is much more fundamentalist than you might get in a lot of other places that are nominally Christian.
Right. And also a better funded branch of evangelical Christianity than what we typically see. So specifically, the references of evolution that have been removed, one of them is the Archaeopteryx, one of the most famous transitional fossils ever found, have been removed. As well, the Society for Textbook Revision also plans to have references to human evolution and finch beaks removed as well. Finch beaks, of course, referring to Darwin's finches. So as I was reading more about the story, I saw a few comments from South Koreans who were taking issue with the phrasing of the story. It's been getting a lot of doom and gloom reporting. And a few have suggested that this is at most a hollow victory for creationists. They attest that evolution is still being taught in Korean high schools, and the removal of material from the textbooks is small, you know, in comparison to the amount of science it is being taught. So I can understand that. It's not like they've banned evolution and that if you teach it, you're going to go to jail or anything. This is not a death blow. But it's not like universities, you know, are going to be able to say, okay, well, students are getting, you know, a so-so education in evolution, ergo, you know, we'll just teach them as usual. They're going to have to do follow-up, like way our universities have to do follow-up and help students unlearn all the crap that they've learned in high school.
I thought one of the other issues that was at play here as well is that in Canada, United States, textbooks have to have a very sort of strict guidelines as to what they have to put into their textbooks. So they have, you know, textbooks are approved by government agencies and then they're published, whereas in Korea, there isn't the same sort of approval mechanism going out. One of the reasons why the ministry had sent out this to the publishers for them to decide is because they have a very laissez-faire attitude towards textbooks, and that they don't actually have a scientific committee like we may have in order to do some vetting. Although, again, those scientific committees in the United States have been taken over by creationists, but it's that sort of idea.
Right. And while I do recognize that this is not, you know, a death blow to science in Korea, it is still a fairly big deal. And we've seen the direction of creationism in the U.S. and elsewhere, and they have a pretty well-established strategy for doing this sort of thing. As Don mentioned, they will infiltrate school boards, and then they'll rely on support from their conservative, you know, religious public to help them manipulate the system and push through textbooks that, you know, exclude evolution or exclude the Big Bang, whatever it is they're trying to do. They disguise their attack as scientific criticism. They refer to creationism as creation science or intelligent design. And these tactics are meant to cause doubt amongst moderate believers, give the impression that the jury is still out when it comes to evolution. This manufactured controversy then fuels more revision and more debate, which then further drives this wedge of misunderstanding and undermines the teaching of evolution. So you might ask yourself, how can an industrialized nation like the U.S. have 40% of their people not believe evolution? Well, it didn't happen overnight. It was a long process of creating doubt. First, it was minor doubt and you know, questions about debating and such and such. And it worked its way to the point where so many people started to say, well, wait a second, if there's all this debate going on, then there must be something to this whole argument about creation science. And that's the first step. So that's what we're noticing here in South Korea. So, well, you know, it's not a slam dunk for creationists. South Korean skeptics and scientist proponents, they should not try to shrug this off. They should take this as the first shot of what could be a very protracted battle. And I saw something else when I was researching this. Have you ever heard of the TIMSS?
No, I haven't heard of the TIMSSIS.
No, just SS.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What is this bizarre group?
Well, it is a test beginning in 1995 and every 4 years after. It's called the Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, And every, 4 years, they test, 4th, 8th, and 12th grade students across the globe on science and mathematics. And then they take all this data and they say, okay, well, which country is educating its young the best? So in science, students in the United States have ranked 3rd at the 4th grade level, which is really good. But they fell to 17th place at 8th grade level. And they only rose up to the 16th place of the test when they reached grade 12. Now, students from South Korea, by comparison, were 1st in 4th grade, as well as 8th grade. They didn't test their students at the 12th grade for some reason. But, clearly there was a bit of a mismatch here between the U.S. and South Korea.
Where did we place?
I don't know if Canada even actually participated. Oh. But We will post a link, and people can go check it out for themselves. Now, to quote Dr. Michael Zimmerman, he wrote an article on the Huffington Post about this. So, quote, "Koreans will soon realize that when biology education removes evolution as the organizing principle for the discipline, students will no longer be able to make sense of the science. Without evolution serving as a central idea tying all facets of biology together, all that's left is a collection of random facts and experiments. Teaching biology without evolution is akin to teaching history simply by asking students to memorize dates. No context, no integration of ideas, no learning." What I found so telling about that quote was that this is exactly how they teach history. So if you don't want people in South Korea and elsewhere to be as dumb when it comes to history as we are right now, then teach evolution and teach it properly.
And I get really, really, really frustrated with the whole idea of creationism itself. I mean, if you're an intelligent design person, I think you're wrong, and I think you're crazy for subtle reasons. If you're a theistic evolutionary person who thinks that evolution's true, but it's all part of God's great plan, okay, so we may have some more difficult arguments, but to be a creationist, especially a young earth creationist, not only means you deny the idea of evolution, but you deny cosmology, you deny geology, you deny a whole plethora of other things. I mean, you have to be so willingly ignorant to believe or to disbelieve in this sort of element, in the same way that you really must credibly believe the earth is flat, because the Bible says so, that the sun revolves around the earth, because the Bible says so, and that everything that points differently must be some grand conspiracy against you or your beliefs. I mean, it is so, so difficult for you to be a creationist in today's society that you are not only ignorant, but you are damn ignorant.
Well, that's a good point, and it's an interesting way of analyzing the creationist claims, because, as you say, if their evidence is so convincing, they can throw out all these other fields, you'd think they'd have a lot of things to say in debates, but they don't really. What they do is they attack evolution. See, that's an interesting way of examining whether or not your science is actually science. If you spend more time attacking somebody else's position and attacking their evidence rather than presenting your own evidence, you might be barking up the tree of pseudoscience.
Well, and they also say, well, the only possible answer to these anomalies they may point out, which are not really anomalies, but we'll give them that for the second, the only possible explanation is God, where frankly, aliens are much more plausible, because aliens probably do exist, and there's no logical contradiction to aliens, where, I mean, again, their belief in God is logically contradictory. It's impossible for their God to exist. But even so, it's far infinitely more likely aliens came down and fiddled with our biology, if you want to believe that kind of crackpot
idea. Well, yeah.
Idea.
I mean, because if aliens did do some kind of creation science or whatever, then that doesn't discount all the other sciences that we have. You know, it doesn't make the Earth flat or the sun, revolving around the Earth. Those things stay the same. It's just aliens screwed with us for a while.
We're in some lab or something. And again, there's so much evidence against that, but that is infinitely more plausible than their beliefs, which just makes you wonder why anyone would believe in God at all.
That's a good question. Why would someone believe in God?
Well, apparently, we can read the mind of God.
Really?
An autism study strengthened the idea that we literally read God's mind. A paper published by UBC's own Arya Norenzayan et al., published in PLOS One, entitled "Mentalizing Deficits, Constrained Belief, and Personal God." This was sort of a meta-study of four other previous studies. People with autism appear less likely to believe in God, a discovery that has been strengthened theories that religious belief relies upon one to imagine what God is thinking, a capacity known as mentalizing. Now, to start, I should define a little bit what the term mentalizing means. It's sort of our ability to get into someone's head, to sort of know what they're thinking or feeling. They use a test called a questionnaire called an empathy quotient. Another test, and I think this sort of captures sort of the idea of it, is the mind reading test. So mentalization is for me to sort of look at you and sort of say, I think I know what you're thinking right now, and I will base my behavior upon that. Now, in contrast, there's something called systematizing. Systematizing is where you base your response on the actions of others, reliant on a set of rules. It's a kind of approach you would take to an engineering problem or mathematics or something like that. Now, systematizing and mentalizing are not necessarily mutually exclusive. Systemizing is usually independent of feelings or thoughts of others, but they can be used to anticipate social behavior via mentalizing. So someone who's like really, really good at math may prefer systematizing sort of rules in their general life, or they may like that, but they still can, you know, feel your pain. So they can still use mentalizing abilities. However, people in the autism spectrum tend to lack this capacity of mentalizing and tend to rely almost exclusively on systemizing strategies for social interaction, which is kind of where this leads into the study. As I said, the study is based on four research projects involving anywhere from 25 to 700 participants. Now, granted, 25 people in a study is not a very good study, but it was followed up by a much larger study. Some of these studies attempted to correlate autism spectrum with belief in a personal God. Others correlated mentalizing abilities with belief. The two approaches, I say, sort of overlap because autism spectrum lacks this mentalizing ability. And one of the hypotheses they wanted to test is that men also lack this hypothesis. So some of the questions that they were asking were, you know, when I'm troubled, I find myself wanting to ask God for help. When people pray, they're only talking to themselves. I believe that God is concerned about my problems. Now, they're also involved with some other questions, again, around the mentalizing aspect. Questions such as, I often find it difficult to judge if someone is rude or polite. I am fascinated by how machines work. I always know what people are feeling. Now, they were actually trying to set out three hypotheses. They were trying to use these studies to prove these three. One, to be a little redundant, autism spectrum is inversely related to belief in God. Mentalizing moderates this relation. So the reason why they don't have a belief in God is because of this deficiency. And also that mentalizing mediates the long-known but theoretically ambiguous gender gap between men who seem to have a less strong belief in a personalized God than women. Now, the judgment of the autistic spectrum, they used a autistic spectrum quotient. It's a 50-item questionnaire that detects nominal individual differences in autism between people of normal levels of intelligence. Sample items, again, is I prefer to do things over and over again. I am fascinated by numbers. I find social situations easy. Now, these, of course, were self-reporting studies, so there was the potential for some bias in there. So in some of the studies, they attempted to counter for this by having the parents of the test subjects, now some of these were students, fill out a similar questionnaire and correlate whether the two sort of jived. Consistently, the study showed that the lack of mentalizing ability led to less belief in a personal God. Now, of course, as good scientists, we should attempt to rule out alternative hypotheses or causalities. So they attempted to provide alternative explanations for this lack of belief. One alternative is that high levels of autism cause adjustment difficulties in social situations, which lead to lower levels of religious attendance, which in turn reduces one's religious belief. That is, going to church is a social activity. If you're a person who finds social situations uncomfortable, you're less likely to participate. As churches are one of the primary recruiting areas for the belief in God, these people are sort of self-selected out, and thus it's not so much their mentalizing abilities that leads to this disbelief, but lack of church attendance. A second possible alternative is sort of the reverse causation. That is, people who are religiously involved somehow causes higher levels of mentalizing. That belief in God encourages greater social involvement in religious groups and activities, which in turn increases our mentalizing tendencies and decreases the likelihood of us being on the autism spectrum, as judged by the questionnaire. This reverses the first hypothesis by stating that those who attend churches are often more likely to develop mentalizing abilities. Now, these were eliminated as possibilities when the researchers controlled for religious attendance and found that the same disbelief correlated with autism spectrum. So given that two individuals who attend church roughly the same number of times a week, the person on the autism spectrum individuals are less likely to believe in a personalized God, which leads to one of the things that may be a bit confusing is this is a personal God as opposed to a belief in God in general. So a number of people who were involved in this study went to church and believed in God, but were more, I guess, of the deist or sort of God is out there, but there is no person named God.
Right. They're not assuming that this God interacts with them on a daily basis or something.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like the president or prime minister. He's out there, but he doesn't know I exist, and he doesn't care about me or anything like that. So it is possible that autism spectrum is associated with interest in math, science, and engineering, which reduces religious belief. As stated earlier about systematizing, autism spectrum people are more likely to feel comfortable and attracted to areas that rely on this, like math and science. Because they are more knowledgeable in both the scientific method, i.e. standards of evidence and proof, and scientific knowledge in general, this would, of course, tend to counteract the possibility of their belief in a personal God, because if you're a rational, logical individual, you know it's all crazy. So it's this sort of preference for systematizing that leads to less belief. However, one study specifically controlled for this systematizing and love of math preference and showed that it actually didn't independently predict belief, meaning that people who were equally enamored with physics and those with poor mentalizing belief were less likely to believe. So it wasn't so much that you had a lot more knowledge and that led to disbelief, although there was a slight linkage to that. It was this inability to mentalize that was actually the defining factor between them. The fourth, of course, was the link between autism and low belief in God is actually explained by general intelligence. Now, they took this also into consideration and statistically controlled for IQ and showed that there was no actual connection between one's level of IQ and belief, relatively speaking, to one's autism and mentalizing ability. In all cases, autism spectrum was the strongest predictor of belief in God with a strong negative correlation. They also proved empirical evidence to support the intuitive idea that men are poor at mentalizing, and this correlates to less belief in God, which I guess is funny in its own size. So men literally have trouble knowing how you feel, and women seem to do.
Well, I mean, there was that old idea going around. I don't know if it's been sort of discredited, that autism was like an extreme form of maleness.
Okay. I don't remember that one, but...
Oh, it was out there.
It also actually correlates, oddly enough, that a significant majority of people who suffer from the autism spectrum are men. Mm-hmm. So that may play into it. So this again, adds to the growing evidence that, in one sense, our brains have a predilection to believe a sort of out-of-body intelligence. And this kind of makes sense in an evolutionary standpoint. When we look at other people, if we assume they have minds like us and they're not zombies and that they think like us, our ability to form strong social communities become possible. If we assume that a deer or a lion also has minds like us, we can kind of start to predict their behavior, and thus hunting becomes much more successful, and for the lion, less so. So evolutionary would seem to want people to assume things that they interact with have minds. In those cases, there where they don't, i.e. a tree or weather, the evolutionary cost would be negligible. While not applying it would seem to be quite different, i.e. see that bear that's over there, it looks hungry, maybe it is hungry, and we just ignore that and, well, we're dead. So, of course, to primitive people, this system works well, and gods, again, are sort of a minor inconvenience because in the grand scheme of things, they don't amount to that much. However, when our knowledge expands beyond sort of the first-person perspective and we could systematize our reality, well, these primal throwbacks, like belief in God, become delusional, literally delusional, and a strong conviction despite superior evidence to the contradictory. And it causes so much more hardship in our society because we rely upon this sort of systematized view of the universe. And if you go against that systematized view of the universe, well, science fails, and a lot of things that we literally depend upon in our society no longer really becomes possible.
But I mean, not to say that it's pretty important for us to be able to imagine, you know, being inside someone else's head. Because without that, we'd have no humanism, we'd have no really interest in being compassionate or kind or anything like that to someone else. So we need to have equal amounts of both. To a certain extent.
Right. No, I think where this comes into is how we apply it. So to a certain degree, to have a certain level of aggression, right, is good because it helps motivate us. It helps us to go out and do stuff because we want to, you know, this sort of drive. But if you have too much of aggression, it leads to violence, and violence is a social negative. So as you're very well point out, our ability to exist in a society is dependent upon our mentalizing ability. I have to assume that you think more or less like I do, otherwise society also starts to break down. But it's the cost-benefit analysis here. If I rely totally on that ability, and I do so blindly, I assume everything. I remember in one of Sam Harris's, I think it was Sam Harris's book, said that 40% of Americans think their tires feel pain. I mean, that's just, that's taking that, you know, I think you feel like I feel, one step way too far. And that's where we have to be careful with this, right? Is that when we begin to understand how it plays into us, and actually studies like this I think are quite good in that regard, is it helps define, one, that it actually exists. So when people with religious beliefs say they know what God is thinking, they can sense it, you can sit back and in a rational sort of say, well, okay, now, I understand where that's coming from, that they are not literally crazy, that we all have this innate tendency to do this particular activity, but for them, they've taken it that one step too far, and we say, okay, so you're right about what you're doing, you're wrong in how you're applying it.
Right. So I guess the answer then is moderation in all things.
Yes, I think Aristotle had said something like that.
Yeah, probably. He's a smart guy. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, listeners. I would like to welcome to the Radio Free Thinker virtual studio, Iglika Ivanova. Iglika Ivanova is a public interest researcher at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. She has a master's degree in economics, which she uses to investigate issues and trends in healthcare, education, and social programs. And she examines the impact public services have on the quality of life. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show, Don.
A significant number of our listeners are or were university or college students. We have been riveted to the news coming out of Quebec with protests over the increase in tuition fee. Now, it's beyond the expertise of my guest here about the political firestorm that has arisen out of these grievances, but I thought it would be an excellent opportunity to delve into tuition fees and student debt. At the heart of the issues in Quebec are the increases in tuition fees. It is claimed that they are necessary to pay for Quebec's post-secondary system. To assess that claim, I thought first I would ask a simple question. Where exactly does a university or college get its money from?
Well, since the early 20th century, when we've seen an increase in the number of Canadian universities and post-secondary education in general, Canadian universities have gotten their money through a mix of government funding and student tuition fees. However, over that time period, the mix has changed. You know, how much comes from funding from government and how much comes from student tuition. And in particular, since the 1990s, we have seen an increased withdrawal of government support and increased reliance on more and more of the university funding coming through tuition. So if you want some numbers, I can throw some numbers at you. For example, 30 years ago, in 1979, about 84% of university funding came from government support, so the vast majority. In 2009, only 58% of the university funding comes from government. So there's been a huge decline there, and tuitions increased in prominence threefold. So it used to be around 12% of all government, of all university funding, and now about 35% of the university funding comes from tuition fees. So huge change there.
Excellent. And actually, we do. We like numbers on this show because, again, a lot of people will sit there and they will say, well, I think things are getting worse. But the empirical evidence is an important part of that. And we appreciate you throwing those numbers in there. So there's been a great decline in the amount of money that the actual government is spending. It's still providing the majority of funding to universities. Once the universities gets this money, where exactly do they spend it?
Well, a big chunk of what universities spend their money on is educating students and providing student support services. So a lot of that goes into salaries for university teachers and for the support staff. But universities see themselves, and they are multi-purpose organizations. So they also engage in research and community service, as well as in teaching. And then they also teach graduate students as well as undergraduates. So it would be inaccurate to attribute all of the university expenses to the undergraduate teaching that we often talk about. At present, universities aren't required and don't publicly report on what percentage of their budget goes to which one of these three main areas, teaching, research, and community service. But University of Western Ontario economists who've done some research on that estimate that about half of operating funding for universities goes towards teaching undergraduate. So that's roughly, if you look at the budget, about half goes towards teaching undergraduate.
And of course, I mean, things like research should be in some ways more the responsibility of government itself than the students who are going there. Now, I've heard this in the United States, and I don't know if it's relevant or true in Canada, that a number of schools now are spending far much more money on fundraising campaigns than they do on things like research or the faculty.
I'm not sure what the numbers are, but definitely we've seen an increased amount of fundraising activity in Canada. And that's because of the withdrawal of government support that I talked about. I mean, historically, in the United States, there have been a lot more private universities that have exclusively relied on students' tuition and fundraising to pay their bills. But in Canada, since the big expansion of post-secondary education happened in the early 20th century, we've sort of decided that education is in the public domain and universities have been public, so government paid for most of the bills. But over the last 20 years, as we've seen the decline in government funding, there's been more and more attention paid to fundraising. I was reading an article by UBC Deputy Chancellor Doug Oram, who says that at the minimum now, universities' presidents can expect to spend a quarter of their time on fundraising. So that's a huge change. They used to spend virtually no time on fundraising, now they spend a quarter of their time. And we know they're very highly paid. So even if you just count the salary of the university president, that's a big chunk right there.
Wow. Now, related to that is the connection between universities and private businesses or corporations, as far as them providing large grants and donations, but a lot of them with strings attached. Is there much stronger ties between universities and private corporations, and what's the cost of that connection?
Well, I think there's some concern that's been expressed into how research may be influenced in terms of either topics of research interest or, you know, at the extreme, universities' freedom of expression, how that may be influenced by companies and their donations. I imagine the universities try their best to maintain independence, but the more they rely on private fundraising, the more I think people are right to ask these questions and to raise concern about conflict of interest. I don't think you can get away from that.
Do universities make more money from these donations now than tuition fees themselves, or is that still distant?
Oh, it's distant for Canadian universities. The stats that I was looking at show that a very small amount of total funding comes from donations, about 10 times less than comes from tuition fees. And there's a bit more money universities get from investments because some of them have endowment funds because they don't necessarily spend all the donations, right? A lot of universities started to accumulate endowment funds and that they invest and then spend the sort of interest off of those investments. So bigger universities like University of Toronto and UBC have large endowment funds, and the interest they get every year actually surpasses the amount of money they can collect yearly in donations from people like alumni, you know, other small donation.
Good news then on that front. But let's go back to tuition fees. I was reading an article by Andrew Coyne in which he stated that in Quebec, students only pay about 17% of the cost of running universities and that the Canadian average is about 40%. Is this true? And does this not lead to some credence that students are sort of pampered?
Well, I'm not sure where this article got the numbers, but they're a little more exaggerated than the numbers I have seen. While it is true that Quebec tuition fees are lower than the national average, the gap isn't quite as big as this suggests. If your listeners are interested in numbers, the Canadian Association of University Teachers compiles grade statistics on university finances annually and publishes it for free on their website. So according to their data, they show that about 21% of university funding in Quebec comes from tuition, so not 17, 21, and about 35% is the national average. So the gap isn't quite as big, but it is large. Now, how do other provinces compare? A lot of other provinces are also in the 20s, like less than 30% of funding comes from tuition, including Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and PEI. And then the only places where tuition fees are particularly high are Ontario and BC, basically. So we have some of the highest reliance on tuition fees here in BC as a share of university funding. We are over 40%. And Quebec is less. Does that mean the students are pampered? I don't know. It really depends on your point of view. For example, BC has the lowest corporate tax rate. Does it mean that our corporations are pampered? You know, these kind of questions come up.
Quite an interesting comparison, because someone from my particular view on the world would actually say, yes, they are. So maybe you're right. We have to be careful when we use standards to apply them consistently.
But basically, Canadian provinces do get independence on how they set tuition fees and government support for university. And university education falls within provincial jurisdiction. And in Canada, our government is such that provinces get quite a bit of independence to decide how they want to set those rates of support. So what people voted for and what government decided to go for.
You know, we talked about the independence of universities. And again, you said that roughly you do not believe that there's a significant influence on our universities because of this economic need universities have. They are under a lot of stress to maintain their budgets to supply what they are supplying. And sometimes it seems they're almost desperate to get anyone to give them money. And in doing so, there is this conflict of interest issue. But you said you don't think that's as big of an issue in Canada as it is in some place like the United States. Or what about Europe?
I'm not sure what the situation is in Europe. I think it's not as big of an issue in Canada as in the United States, but it is rising in prominence. And trying to remember, there's fairly recently some controversy in the media about a research chair funded by a corporation or in one of the universities, but I cannot remember which one. I believe it was in Ontario. And there was a big thing about whether it's compromising the integrity of the research. And I think that private funding and the problems it creates mostly relate to research rather than teaching. And most of the work I have done on university policy has related to teaching. So I'm not as much of an expert in what's happening on the research front. I think it's important. I think it needs more government support to avoid these potential conflict of interest. My sense is that universities are trying to avoid them, but they are becoming more of a concern as time goes on, not less of a concern. So we'll probably hear more about that in the future.
What role then should the government and public funding play in the post-secondary institution? I know there are a number of countries in the world that actually provide free post-secondary education. Is that something that would be workable here?
I don't see why not. I mean, we managed to provide free healthcare. We should be able to, provide free education if that's what we decide to do. I think that's a good direction to go into. In general, I would say public funding should play a much larger role in funding post-secondary education than it is playing now. And there's great arguments for funding research publicly to maintain independence, as we talked about potential conflict of interest. And also as an economic development strategy, because we all talk about innovation, about knowledge economy, and a lot of that does come from formal education. There's a lot of links with formal education. But not just research, I think government should play a bigger role in funding teaching as well. And there's two big reasons why. One is the traditional reason why we subsidize education to begin with, And that's that there are social benefits from having an educated population that go above and beyond what the individuals gain from getting a degree. So if we just left it to the market and individuals had to pay or, you know, make an investment in themselves, what we would see is an underinvestment from societal point of view in education. We won't have enough people going to school and our economy will suffer. So because there are social benefits from education, we have good reason to fund it collectively as a society. And these benefits, for example, include things like innovation and knowledge creation, which I talked about, but also other things. Like, there's a lot of research that finds that better educated societies are also healthier societies. So that reduces healthcare costs. And independently of that, that people who get the post-secondary education are more active participants in their communities. They volunteer more, and that helps deal with some of the social problems we have. So all in all, there's a lot of positives to having an educated population. So we should, you know, fund education. But also the other reason to fund education publicly is to ensure fair access, to make sure that people who face financial barriers in their youth are not prevented from obtaining an education.
We will return after a little break.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
We're back.
One of the people that I was talking to in preparation for this particular interview had asked me a very interesting question. He says, you know, isn't it sort of a fundamental principle of, you know, our classic capitalist society that as you produce more of something, the sort of per unit cost goes down? And right now we have more people, I believe, who are trying to get and are receiving a post-secondary education than we've ever had, even as a percentage of society. Shouldn't that mean actually that tuition fees should be going down? Is there something wrong with my analogy?
Well, there seems to be something wrong, because it's not just tuition fees, they're not going down, but the total cost of operating universities, they're not going down. I think it may have to do with the technological developments and, you know, requirements of the current economy, that people have more education and it's becoming more and more complicated. So the cost of providing the education we needed, you know, 50 years ago may have gone down, but now we need a different kind of education and that's being more money. I think we've found that university operating costs have been increasing faster than inflation, faster than other items. And that's the fact. I don't know why, but that is something that we have to deal with.
So many students out there with degrees, does this actually sort of stimulate the economy or kind of suppress it? By that, I mean, when my father got a good job, all he sort of needed was a good attitude. When I was looking, you had to have a high school diploma. However, now it seems like that employers won't even look at an applicant if they don't have a bachelor's degree, even if it's something that's a really sort of mundane job. So this sort of increase in qualifications has sort of elevated the market in some degrees, but it's also made those people on the lower end much less in demand and able to be paid less. Overall, does this stimulate the economy with everyone getting the degree or not?
Well, I think that some people have expressed concern about what they call education inflation, or the fact that now more and more people are getting education. And does this devalue the value of the degrees, the standard supply and demand principles? If you have more graduates, like higher supply, would that reduce their wages? But economics research that's looked at the university education premium, so sort of the increased earnings of people with degrees, consistently finds that over the last 20 years in Canada, we've actually seen an increase of the university education premium. So it pays more now to get a university degree than it did 20 years ago. So that makes economists think that the increase in university degrees that we see, or the increase in education, is driven by demand from the labor market. So it's not just like exogenous supply, it's not just a decision of the students to get the education, but that the labor market actually needs those people to have degrees, and that's why it continues to reward them with higher salaries. But I think you're onto something, because we have seen a corresponding decline in the wages of people who don't have education beyond high school. And that is of a concern, especially if you think that access to education is not necessarily very equitable. And if people who come from lower income families don't get to go to school, and there's some evidence that they don't, then that's a problem, because then they are stuck in very low wage situations that creates problems with social mobility and increased income inequality in society.
So overall, it seems like if you do have a university degree, you will get a better job. And if you don't, that will have some negative effects. But doesn't actually one of the side effects of our current system of funding it actually run against that in a certain degree? By that, when students graduate with a degree, most of them have huge student loan debts. With pressure, of course, to make payments on these, many students, if not most students, are forced to take jobs that are well below their technical abilities. So again, doesn't this sort of suppress the economy by having a lot of these students out there? And as soon as they're graduating with these huge student loan debt.
I think that the student loan debts are a problem. And in fact, there's research from Statistics Canada that looks at the sort of the impact of graduating with a student loan 10 years later and what impact that has on your finances. So it finds that people who have taken out student loans do have problems with their finances long after graduation. And that the fact that we're seeing increasing level of student loans should make us worry. But the fact that we are seeing high level of student loans, that's not something that's not a natural consequence of people getting education. That's a public policy choice. We've decided to ask students to pay for their education upfront and finance it through debt. There's other ways to finance education. There's other ways to get people to be educated. They don't have to graduate with that much debt. So I think that is a public policy choice. And I think we will have to reconsider it sometime very soon, because we're starting to see higher and higher household debt. And student debt is part of it. And it is creating a problem for our society. I think we should reconsider not just tuition, but also student aid and how we help students, and whether maybe we should have more grants versus loans.
Well, that's actually was going to be my follow-up question. We did sort of mention already that one way to do this is just to have the government flip the bill for universities out of taxation, basic taxation. What are some of the other models that you're sort of alluding to that might also work?
Well, the other models would be to have more grants. And there's an interesting comparison here, again, between Europe and the United States. Because what we see in most of Europe, especially in Northern Europe, is increased tendencies of governments to just foot the bill through general taxation. In the United States, however, they don't like paying for things through general taxation, so they charge high fees. But there's some research I've seen, very interesting, that says that the average student loan is lower in the United States than in Canada, because they have better grants for lower income people. And while we have very limited grants and provide most of our financial aid through loans that are repayable, the United States have a big system of federal grants for lower and middle income students. However, they still have huge problems with income inequality and huge problems with accessibility of universities. So their social mobility is lower than ours. So it raises the question of, if we're aiming to get to the level of education, attainment, accessibility, and social mobility of Europe, should we try to implement funding models from the United States that focus on targeting lower income students for grant support? Or should we implement the funding models from the countries we're trying to emulate, like Northern Europe, where they just pay for it through taxation?
Very interesting choice there. Is that a very significant issue in Canada with regards to the inequality and discrimination? I mean, obviously, middle and well-off individuals can afford to go to university. Is it really, really difficult for low-income people to do it as much as it would have been 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. The unfortunate part of it that I see as a researcher is there's very little data that is collected on this issue of who goes to university and who doesn't go. A lot of the research on it was done by the now defunct Canada Millennium Scholarship Foundation that was founded for a few years there in the early 2000s to look at the issues of post-secondary education, but then it mandate expired and was not renewed. So There's nobody really now that provides this kind of statistics. But it's interesting, and it will be interesting to your listeners, that a couple of years ago, I think in 2010, the UBC School of Medicine had a very publicized media campaign of trying to get more students from lower socioeconomic background to go into medical school, because they noticed that they had very good racial diversity in their program, and they had both men and women roughly equally represented. However, everyone came from upper income or wealthier families. There were virtually no students who came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. So they were trying to figure out how to attract more. But they are sort of an exception rather than the rule of a program that actually looked at itself to assess its socioeconomic diversity and try to do something about it. We, by and large, don't know, you know, who goes, especially to those professional programs that are very expensive, like law, medicine, and business. But I wouldn't be surprised if we find very skewed socioeconomic distribution there of the students.
Well, thank you for your time and your input today. Is there any last words you'd like to impart to our audience?
In terms of last words, I guess one thing I'd like to say is that we need to have better educated society. We know that a lot of the jobs that will be created over the next decade or so will require post-secondary education. So we need to get people to get the education. It costs what it costs. It's expensive, and costs have been decreasing. So really, the only question isn't, do we get our youth educated? The question is, what's the fairest and most effective way to pay for it? Do we charge the students up front and get them to amass huge student loans, or do we pull more of our money through taxes and publicly fund universities?
Very, very good. Thank you very much. Listen again, folks, next week, where we will talk about poverty.
Hello, this is Leo Iwe, Nigerian skeptic, global humanist, and a tireless proponent of rational compassion in the global community. Help promote skepticism and rational thinking by listening to Radio Free Thinker. Please subscribe on iTunes. Rational compassion is all about our applying our reason to help humanity, to help enlighten the world.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So we're running out of time here on the show, though. So
are we?
We are, unfortunately. We have to go to our skeptical highlights right about now.
Well, I've got two skeptical highlights for this week. One, why do religions endure? Another, Philosopher's Cafe forum, where Charles Maxer ponders why religions endure and why anyone would imagine they wouldn't. Well, I can come up with a few reasons, but you can come in and participate in the discussion and find out why he thinks they may always be around. This is being held at June 13th, 7 p.m. at White Rock Central Library. Cost is free. The other one is Ethics and Marijuana Business, Why We Need to Make Pot Legal. As part of the Workplace Center for Spiritual and Ethical Development, Ethics for Breakfast series, legal affairs columnist Ian Melgrew leads a discussion about the legal and ethical implications of legalizing marijuana. Obviously, from the title, you kind of know where they stand on it. This is at June 13th at the god-awful hour of 7:15 a.m. to 8:30. It's at the BC Hydro Building, which is 333 Dunsmuir, and $10 for that. So it could be interesting. I'm not sure whether it's part of the Make Pot Legal, whether they're going to have brownies available, but you never know.
Well, I mean, I don't know, 8 in the morning, though? I mean, that's kind of...
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're in the life, in quotation marks, then that might just be very late, you know?
That is possible. My skeptical highlight is Vancouver Slut Walk 2012. This, of course, is the satellite event of Slut Walk Toronto, which was organized in 2011 as a response to a comment made by a Toronto police officer who suggested that students who were being assaulted can avoid this by not dressing like sluts. So obviously the point of the whole walk is to go out and talk against victim blaming and sex shaming and all these sort of things that are happening. It's happening Saturday, June 30th at 2 p.m., starting at the Vancouver Art Gallery, 750 Hornby Street, for those of you who don't know. And much like last year, we encourage you to go out there, whether or not you want to walk with a group or your friends, whatever purpose you have, it's a great time to go out there and show some solidarity and stand up for people dressing the way they want to dress and not having to be sexually assaulted for it.
And this is also, I think, part of the idea of taking back a name. I mean, the term slut is considered a derogatory term, but perhaps an inappropriate one, and therefore sort of like the, what happened with queer and something like that, right? Is the community went out and said, listen, this is a term you're using to denigrate me. Well, we're going to take that term back and deny it its power over us. It's ironic that we were talking about before the show about this study that Ethan was sort of listening to, or not a study yet, it's a pre-study, I guess would be the best word, about the female stereotypes in video gaming. And this person who published this particular appeal, yes, was inundated by, well, not appropriate comments, and perhaps one would even say some quite bizarre tangential insults.
Well, I mean, the whole point of something like this, like Slutwalk, is that you need to be somewhat inflammatory to even get a response. And there are a lot of people out there who take issue with the name Slutwalk, and for good reasons, but the organizers are trying to make a statement. And in order to make that statement, you have to be a bit intense with your language. So, I mean, again, like I said, it's not like they're demanding everybody dress a certain way or hold up signs a certain way. It's really just an opportunity to go out there, hit the street, and, you know, lend your support to an idea that is very worthy of attention, at least in my opinion. So that pretty much covers us for Radio Free Thinker. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
So long, folks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships.
We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe is in us. Yes, the universe is in us. We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe itself exists within us. We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe is in us. Yes, the universe is in us.
Every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. You all started us. You all started us. From a star that exploded.
Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way. Called by the universe, reaching out to the universe.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way, reaching out to the universe with these methods and tools of science.
Called by the universe.
Stand in the middle and enjoy everything both ways. The tininess of us, the enormity
the atoms that make up the human body are traceable to the crucible that cooked light elements into heavy elements. These stars went unstable in their later years and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy. Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us. We are stardust in the highest exalted way, called by the universe, reaching out to the universe.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way, reaching out to the universe with these methods and tools of science. We are stardust in the highest exalted way, in the highest reaching out. The universe itself exists within us. The universe is in us.